This is Bristol Bay and Beyond for December 12th, 2014. I'm your host, Dave Benninger at KDLG. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up, we'll talk Pebble's ongoing lawsuit against EPA with attorney Heather Kendall Miller. We'll look at a few projects in Bristol Bay and beyond. Gabe Dunham is here to talk fishing industry news and more. First, a look back at some of the stories from the past week. On Monday night in Barrow, 48-year-old State Assistant District Attorney Brian Sullivan was shot and killed, allegedly by 47-year-old Ronald Fisher, who was arrested a short time later. Police and troopers say Fisher may have killed Sullivan in a jealous rage over Sullivan's relationship with the mother of Fisher's estranged children. Fisher was arraigned on a first-degree murder charge and is being held on $500,000 bail. On Tuesday night, an accident between an SUV and an ATV outside of Naknek claimed the life of 55-year-old Orville Grote. Grote was driving the ATV. He died from injuries not long after being transported to the clinic for treatment. On Wednesday, the U.S. House passed a Coast Guard bill, or the U.S. Senate, rather, passed a Coast Guard bill that includes a three-year moratorium on vessel discharge permitting for boats under 79 feet, and the U.S. House soon followed. California Democrat Senator Barbara Boxer said on the Senate floor that politics prevented making it a permanent solution.
It's the best we can do, and I want the American people and the fishermen to know we tried so hard to get this fixed permanently.
On Thursday, Senator Mark Begich said his goodbyes on the floor of the U.S. Senate. Defeated by Republican Dan Sullivan in the November general election, Begich ends his tenure with this Congress. He urged his colleagues to be optimistic and get to work.
People may be angry with us, but they want to know what we're going to do to solve these incredible problems. And it will be incumbent upon the next Congress to sit down and work together. It's going to be tough, because the politics of today are about the moment in time. It's not about the long term.
Also this week, the Koliganek varsity volleyball team was forced into an emergency landing. This happened Wednesday after the Denina airplane they were on damaged a tire taking off from the Koliganek airport. The pilot was able to land the team, two coaches, and one parent smoothly in King Salmon with crash rescue crews on standby Wednesday afternoon. The girls' first round matchup against Unalaska was delayed till late Thursday evening, and they came back from two games down to claim the win and advance to tonight's semifinals. The Lady Wolverines also beat Sioux Valley yesterday and will take on Craig in the semifinals tonight as well. We learned today that longtime Bristol Bay resident Jack Moores has passed away recently. Robin Samuelson spoke with us earlier to share some thoughts.
Jack Moores, better known in Bristol Bay as Alligator Jack, worked for the state of Alaska for many years. And then he went to work for the Bristol Bay State of Corporation and ran their land department for a good number of years. Jack's been out here in Bristol Bay probably 40 some years, working in different aspects on different jobs, but he was well known in Bristol Bay, and Jack was also a commercial fisherman. He bought a drift permit and bought a boat and drift fished in Bristol Bay, and he was like one of the locals out here, and was a pretty exciting guy.
I've had the pleasure to meet him only just once, but everybody that has spoken about him says there's just a lot of stories about that guy because he's been out here just doing so many different things. I'd guess that everybody probably has at least one good story from him. What about yourself?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he used to come out and use my wife's assistance net, and he'd usually have some dummies with him to help him. And he'd rip up my wife's subsistence net, and we'd both growl at him, we're never going to allow him to use our subsistence net again. And next spring, as soon as the wife was done, he'd be there bumming our subsistence net. Jack was a well-liked guy in Bristol Bay and well-respected, and he's done a lot of good for the people of Bristol Bay. We're going to miss him.
Hey, Robin, thanks for sharing some thoughts here today. I appreciate it.
You bet you. Thank you.
Well, to another topic today, this concerning the proposed Pebble Mine. Federal Judge Russell Holland granted the Pebble Limited Partnership a temporary injunction against the EPA's actions on the Bristol Bay watershed. This happened late in November. This is part of Pebble's second case in federal court against EPA and has been interpreted by some as something of a setback for the agency's recent efforts here in our watershed. I spoke with attorney Heather Kendall Miller, who represents the United Tribes of Bristol Bay, one of the groups leading the opposition to Pebble. Heather, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Let's go back to the November ruling, the first ruling from Judge Holland in this, I think, the third case that Pebble has filed against EPA. Tell us what Holland's ruling really came down as. It's hard to interpret, I guess.
Well, I want to be absolutely clear about what case you are talking about. Pebble Limited has filed three different cases. The first case dealt with the merits of EPA's authority to initiate the 404C proceeding. And Judge Holland dismissed those claims, and that case is up on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. The second case that was filed by Pebble Limited involves what's known as the Federal Advisory Committee Act.
And this is
and
the case that,
that
he
act,
this is what he ruled on, this case.
That's right.
Okay. And so tell us what FACA is exactly, because that's a confusing term even right off the bat.
FACA is a federal law that was passed that is intended to require that any committees that are established to give recommendations to federal agencies, that they be composed of individuals that are fairly balanced in terms of their points of view represented.
So, for example, if EPA hired folks on the periphery to conduct either some research or to bring information into them, they're supposed to be vetted to be fair and equal because they're funded by taxpayers, I suppose.
That's right.
Okay.
The idea is that agencies are getting the point of view that from the public that represent all sides. And so the complaint that was filed by Pebble alleges that in the process of adopting and developing the watershed assessment plan, that EPA relied upon three different groups of individuals that were treated like informal federal advisory committees, and that these committees helped EPA in developing the facts and information that went into the watershed assessment. And they made a claim that there were three different groups of these federal advisory committees, supposedly. And the first group consisted of Anti-Mine Coalition, and these were allegedly the environmental non-governmental organizations and anti-mine activists and lawyers and lobbyists.
We might just point out that's Pebble's term, correct? That's not a term that exists.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
So that's right.
They're alleging there's the Anti-Mine Coalition.
That was the first. The second consisted of the anti-mine scientists. And then the third group were members of EPA's Bristol Bay assessment team, including individuals who are not employed by the federal government, but were members of the intergovernmental technical team. And Pebble alleged in their FACA violation that EPA used these contractors to help it write parts of the watershed assessment and for allowing Bristol Bay tribal representatives to participate in the development of the watershed assessment. And Judge Holland, at a November 24th hearing, found that the first two contentions were not persuasive, and that is he threw out the claims regarding the Anti-Mine Coalition and the anti-mine scientists. But he said that Pebble had demonstrated at least a fair chance of success on the merits of the third claim. So he said that while they may be able to show the potential of harm, that it was not going to harm EPA to slow its process down to allow Pebble to essentially rewrite its complaint.
Okay, that was sort of the first, I don't know if you can call it a win, but the first success Pebble has had in federal court in a long time, if ever. They've had some wins in state court, but that seemed to have more implication right off the bat, or does it have an implication? Because essentially what it looks like is that the preliminary injunction was granted and EPA must now stop until further ruling. And it seemed like it took the wind out of the sails right there. Or was this big of a deal?
I'd be careful in calling this a win. This is a temporary injunction. Judge Holland let it be known to all parties that he was taking off on his winter holiday. He was going to be gone for a month. So he instructed Pebble to reorganize its complaint and get it filed, and made clear that this was a temporary injunction.
It sounds procedural.
Yes.
Okay.
So this, and he hasn't addressed the merits here. He just said that it appears that there may be a viable claim. And so I'm going to instruct the agency to stand down in finalizing its rule until the court has opportunity to address whether this claim is viable or not.
Is there any concern with your clients that a shifting landscape in Washington, D.C., the Republican majority now in the Senate, is there a possibility that the EPA's authority may be stripped or limited between now and a further ruling from Holland?
Well, that's always possible, and certainly this new Congress has its eye on the EPA. We haven't seen anything, however, yet that was put into what's called the Cromnibus Bill, which is a combination of the continuing resolution and part of the omnibus spending bill. And that was, you know, the new Senate's first chance to take a whack at the EPA.
Okay, so no initial surge from the new Republican.
No.
Okay.
Nothing at this time.
Okay, so we see a little bit of a pushback on the EPA's timeline. One more thing I'd like to ask is, in that lawsuit that they filed, in the FACA lawsuit, are a host of names that everyone that's watched this issue or that lives in this region is familiar with, and emails from many of those people dating back well prior to a request made by the tribes in 2010 for the EPA to get involved. Some of these emails just seem damning on the face of them. Is there concern that these emails may harm, now that they're in the public, may harm the case for using EPA's authority to stop the development of Pebble?
I don't think so. I think that this has been a public process, and that all parties on both sides of this issue have had many opportunities to engage their government on the merits of this mine. So I don't think that emails are necessarily damning. I think they are an example of how the public attempts to engage government on major public policy questions and decisions.
Let's leave it there for now. And Heather, I want to thank you for helping us unpack this very complicated federal court process. And I hope you join us again.
All right. Thank you very much, David.
Again, that was Heather Kendall Miller with the Native American Rights Fund, also representing the United Tribes of Bristol Bay, speaking with us yesterday. Well, let's take a look at a few projects in our area. The Wood River Bridge connecting Dillingham to Olecknagik is coming together on schedule, even with its winter break. We sent Thea Card out recently to take a closer look. She brought us this story.
Well, I saw recently somewhere where there was a headline article, well, here's one bridge in Alaska that is to somewhere, I thought is the way they titled it, or something to that
Dillingham
effect.
Resident Dan it Dunaway really drove to me to the construction site. To say that it was windy would be a gross understatement. It was cold and rainy and the roads were terrible. We had to walk past large shipping containers, and then we made our way to what will be the Wood River Bridge. As we stood at the edge of the bridge, the water rushed hurriedly down the river. Dunaway told me a little bit about the history of the project, and a bald eagle swooped down.
Here we go. Got a nice bald eagle flying by right now.
Mowat Construction is the company building the bridge for over $19 million with money from both state and federal sources. Project manager for Mowat, Tim Hutton, is the leader of this bridge project. He was up here during the summer to oversee the work. He says the bridge is looking good.
We're just over 50% complete.
The Wood River Bridge will connect the Bristol Bay communities of Dillingham and Olecknagik. It has two lanes, spans 440 feet long, and provides a minimum of 40 feet of clearance above the river. City Administrator for Olecknagik, Kay Andrews, is excited this project is coming to fruition.
I feel like it would save lives. It will bring our community closer together. There's economic opportunity. Again, safety number one for not only our school children, which was a big motivator behind this project, but also for the people itself to keep them safe.
Andrew says this project is something the community has been working towards for over 20 years.
It's a long time coming.
Although it's not a very long crossing, it can prove dangerous. Andrew says many people have lost their lives trying to cross the river in the fall and the spring when the ice isn't very stable.
My own mother and my uncle drowned on Lake Alaknagik when I was only 6 years old. So I know personally, I know the personal impact losing a loved one on Lake Alaknagik, as well as my Uncle Paul and my cousin Kevin. So just my family alone, we've lost a lot of family members.
However, Andrew says she stays strong and is honored to hold her position in the city.
I just am thankful that I'm able to carry this vision through.
Hutton says construction will pick up again in April and the bridge will be completed by October 2015. In Dillingham, I'm Thea Card.
I traveled to Ekwok this week, courtesy of an extra seat on a plane chartered by the Bristol Bay Economic Development Association. I was hoping to get an eye on two new road projects there, one going out to the landfill and another that heads out to Blueberry Hill. On the short visit, however, I missed the chance for a tour of those projects, but there were other things that caught my eye in the village. I stopped by the Sonny Nelson School, where K-3 teacher Patty Lindau, in her second year at the school, first as a full-time teacher, pointed out some fresh paint and new decorations lining the school's one hallway.
Okay, the walls here used to be all brown, which make more of a darker environment at the beginning of the year. So the first year was all brown, but then the next school year, all the walls have been painted white, and that was the principal's idea to just make it more lively. And white is a color that makes it feel bigger. And I do believe it has been really successful because it just makes everything nicer, especially also with the doctor's use.
Stop by any school, especially the elementary ones, and you're bound to notice a theme. Ekwok principal Nate Preston went with Seuss this year.
Well, they really like Green Eggs and Ham, the Lorax also. There's not really a specific favorite story, but they seem to like that is just really happy and just motivational, yes. So they start reading and they just laugh.
The Lorax, Grinch, and other familiar characters smile down from the walls, along with pictures from a night when school staff donned Cat in the Hat garb and dished out servings of green eggs and ham.
Well, the principal cooked it, and then I read green eggs and ham. And then Pam Johnson, also from the school district, came. She also read The Cat in the Hat, and she also dressed as the Cat in the Hat. I also didn't dress completely, but I had some the hat and but it was a nice night.
This is Lindau's first year teaching. She says the kids are getting a little anxious about the coming Christmas break and their concert next Friday night. She has enjoyed watching their progress in her first year.
I really enjoy when I can see improvement and I see growth within the students, and that's for me the nicest part of being a teacher. I just like spending time with all of them.
As do I, and several of the kids volunteered to read Christmas stories or poems for KDLG, including this second grader who picked a poem on Christmas Five Little Bells.
Five little bells hanging in a row. The first one said, "Ring me slow." The second one said, "Ring me fast." The third one said, "Ring me last." The fourth one said, "Ring me like a chime." The fifth one said, "Ring me at holiday time."
Good job. Okay, tell me your name.
Talia Barnes.
And what grade are you in?
Second grade.
And what school do you go to?
William Sunny Nelson.
William Sunny Nelson.
You want to say Merry Christmas, everybody?
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Good job. We'll air more stories read by the Ekwok students, along with a dozen or more we've recorded so far from other students in our area, a little bit closer to Christmas. Well, let's look at a third project, this one to our north a bit here. The long-awaited pool in Bethel finally opened this fall and then was immediately shut back down for a variety of unfortunate mechanical reasons and code violations. But that didn't stop the community from finding clever workarounds to get their $25 million dream come true back open to the public. Ben Matheson is a reporter at KYUK in Bethel and has been following along this fall. He joins us now. Hi, Ben. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Dave.
So I understand that after several hurdles, the pool is now back open.
Yeah, the pool's been open for a couple weeks now, but it's been open with the help of what's called fire watch volunteers. The pool's sprinkler system wasn't completely working. It didn't have enough water pressure to fully trigger and turn on, so the city was able to work out a system where people basically walk laps around the facility every hour and make sure there's nothing resembling a fire while crews work on the permanent fix for the fire sprinkler. That's expected to be tested today or tomorrow.
So it sounds like a clever community solution to a problem that may take a little time to fix, but the community has figured a way to get around that.
The community figured a way how to do that, but it came with some frustration. This pool's been in the works for literally decades, Dave. It's something where Bev Hoffman and a group of volunteers around town sold cookies for years and years and years. 20,000 pounds of cookies is what they say to raise money for this. And finally, it came together after years and years of work. So people have been a bit anxious to get in the pool. And
Well, now you were there the opening day, and after all these years, you were on the scene as Bev Hoffman, I think, was the first one down the slide.
She was the first one down the slide, and there was also ceremonial cannonballs, and then hundreds of kids. They did shifts full of kids in the pool. They brought it up to max capacity.
Oh, that's great. So tell us now, how is the community making use of this brand-new, nice facility up there? Are there clubs, or are there classes, or is everybody just coming in for rec time?
One of the big ideas behind this is that it's a life and aquatic health and safety. So the idea is that this region has suffered from really high drowning rates in recent years, in past decades. So swimming lessons and teaching people how to swim is a big goal of this facility. And swimming lessons started on Monday. There's, I think, three different levels for sort of younger beginner swimmers. And there's also plans for adult swimming lessons. It's something where people can go and run on the treadmills, lift weights, soon to have yoga classes, spinning classes, but also just going down the slide and going for a swim.
Yeah, I think that's the other thing that I didn't know about until recently was that it does have a fitness facility component to this complex up there.
One room is a weight room with free weights and bench presses and treadmills and that type of equipment. And then there's a larger kind of open room where you can do yoga classes and Pilates. And the spin bikes, I believe, will be in that facility. There was one mention at the grand opening that Bev Hoffman pointed to what's a wall going out to the tundra. And she said, someday we'll have a big door right here going to the new basketball gym. That's still many, many years off.
But it's nice to see the vision and the progress moving forward. Have you swam a few times yourself now?
I had to go there in person, and
I had
I'm
to
embarrassed
go there.
I'm embarrassed to say that it took me until this week to actually make up to get rid of the excuses of why I couldn't make it there. But I have to say the water's great, the water's clear. This place is really clean. You don't get a lot of sparkling clean places in you know November, December in Bethel. But this place is brand new. The staff is great, and it's really a delight.
So you guys are back in the high life again.
Yes, sir.
Well, Ben Matheson at KYUK in Bethel, thanks for the update. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Dave.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. I'm Dave Benninger. Back with us this week to talk about news in the fishing industry is Marine Advisory Program Agent in Bristol Bay, Gabe Dunham. Gabe, glad to have you again.
Thanks a lot for having me, Dave.
Let's first touch on what seems to be a pretty important topic for the Alaska fishing industry as a whole, especially here in Bristol Bay, which is this moratorium on the EPA's regulations for vessels under 79 feet. What is this all about?
Yeah, Dave, so the big news here is that Congress is expected to pass this three-year moratorium on the small vessel general discharge permit required by the EPA currently for all vessels above 79 feet. But this moratorium basically exempts vessels below 79 feet, which for us really applies to our Bristol Bay fishing fleet. And if this moratorium wasn't passed, for the next year, our fishermen here would be basically exposed to another level of paperwork and regulations that they would have to comply to about things like bilge water and hold effluent and runoff from the deck from washing down after an opening, for example.
Which just sounds extremely extraneous for the average fishing business, especially here in Bristol Bay. And we heard fishermen on the radio this week say, what, do I have to hire a full-time compliance officer now? You know, would it be that severe?
Well, I don't know if it would be that severe, but it is, like I said, another level of paperwork and regulations. And really, a lot of this stuff that's described in this permit is common knowledge and common sense. They're common sense things that any responsible operator out here in Bristol Bay is already doing. Things like making sure your bilge is clean and not pumping oily water out into the ocean where we catch our fish. Fixing hydraulic leaks if you see one, and basic things like taking care of your trash and making sure none of it blows off the top of your boat during high winds or something like that.
Okay, so they're important in principle, and likely most of our fleet abides by it regardless, but what this exempts us from is a paperwork level and potentially a fines that would come along with violations.
Exactly. That's about it.
3-year moratorium, I think the fleet is hoping at some point to get a permanent solution, right? Is that something we could see down the road?
You know, I'm sure that's a possibility. Perhaps more likely is that there'll be a modification of this permit to make it more amenable to the nuances of fishing, especially, and specifically here in the vessels that are less than 79 feet.
Okay. Let's change topics here while we've got you and talk a little bit about salmon markets. Now, it's a long time away before Bristol Bay starts selling its next year's product, but it's not too soon to start looking at market conditions and forecasts. What's on your mind this week?
Well, of course, kind of a hot topic that's going on in the global seafood news is the moratoriums on seafood imports by Russia. While those changing regulations might not necessarily immediately affect seafood supply and demand, I mean, they do affect who gets to sell seafood to whom. And so you're kind of seeing across the news sources kind of a shuffling around of suppliers and marketers going on. That doesn't mean that it's going to immediately affect the prices for salmon specifically as it concerns us here in Bristol Bay. It doesn't mean that it does or doesn't mean that it doesn't, really.
When do we start to see a forecast for market prices for Bristol Bay?
Well, as far as a specific date, I really couldn't give you a specific date, but I mean, I know that it's going to have to be a lot closer to the time where we start producing fish here in the bay, because the prices, salmon prices are going to be based on world markets, of course, and the fluctuations in those markets are constantly occurring. So
and salmon are produced year-round, especially in the farmed markets, so
that's
we're not
correct.
Just waiting on the summer run to various river systems around the world. So what's That's happening
correct.
In the farm markets right now?
Well, in the farm markets, this also goes back a little bit to the issues concerning who can and can't sell fish to Russia now. So Norway is now exporting 9% more than they did last year. And so they're actually saying that 2014 could be a record for Norway's export to the U.S. in the form of fresh whole and filleted Atlantic salmon. Chile's overall salmon production, which includes trout, is down about 4%, but it's up in value a significant amount, and most of that's driven from increases of value in Atlantic salmon. News sources are saying that the U.S. is a really strong demand for farm salmon, with still some other emerging markets for demand going on, specifically China and Brazil. Are sort of picking up their demand for salmon product.
Do we think that an increased market for farmed salmon in the U.S., how does that affect our market? Does it just generally drive the price down, or could it perhaps help us create a niche of wild Alaska-caught salmon under that brand that consumers seek out at a higher price?
That's an excellent question. The demand is not necessarily going to drive prices down typically. It's going to increase prices. And
because of our brand?
Well, presumably, I mean, if you have a higher level of demand and a specifically fixed amount of supply or relatively fixed supply, you're going to see a larger price for that product. the niche marketing that you're touching on is something that's certainly related, but a little bit different. And one of the ideas is that a total increase in demand for all kinds of salmon is good for reflecting some sort of increase in demand for specific niche markets of salmon, of which some of the product that comes out of Bristol Bay is definitely in that category.
Okay. Well, let's leave it there for this week. Gabe, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Dave.
And we're about out of time for this week, but before we go, we'll leave you with a short piece from Dillingham fourth graders who held their Christmas concert yesterday afternoon.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Prospero año felicidad. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas from the bottom of my heart. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas from the bottom of my heart.
Feliz Navidad.
That'll do it for this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond. Catch our repeat Friday night and find most of our stories online at our website, kdlg.org. I'm Dave Benninger at Dillingham. Hasta luego.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Prospero año y felicidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Prospero año y felicidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad.